session number 31509, Reel 7.
But anyway, I went into a flight. We were all divided. There were three flights in 28th Squadron, and I went into B flight. And on my very first trip, when I'd been in the squadron for a few days, they'd let me take a Hurricane up. It was a Hurricane squadron, just to fly around the neighbourhood and get the feel of the aircraft again, and see something of the countryside, which was just treetops actually, for miles and miles and miles jungle, and to get used to the fact you're going to be flying over that kind of terrain. And then I went on my first operation, and that almost ended in disaster, because the flight commander, a Canadian, by the way, Johnny Johnson, no, Richard, it wasn't Johnny Johnson, anyway, Johnson, was the leader, and we always used to go out in pairs, the leader, and he always had a tail flyer who flew behind him and kept looking over his shoulder and was there to warn his pilots and his leader in front, enemy planes on the right team coming in, because he'd be concentrating on other things. He'd be concentrating on, you just followed him because he was navigating as well. So to save the leader being suddenly dived on out of the sun and not knowing anything about it before he's hit, there was a tail man there to call out, "Hey, leader, blah 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 blah." Yeah. Well, we had to fly down the Irrawaddy River to on what was called a hostile reconnaissance. That was, if we saw anything, go in and inspect and hit it. And we, of course, longed to do that. We didn't want to have a flight down the river and come back and say, "We didn't see anything." The Japs were very clever at hiding themselves. They didn't move much in daytime. They moved a lot at night. In daytime, they camouflaged themselves very well. And we went down the Irrawaddy, which was very wide there, went down near Pakoku, where we went to. And Johnny called me up and said, "Gavin, I'm going to take the west side, and you take the east side, and we can just see each other, be small specks, but keep an eye on me, and keep level with me on your side. And when we get to Kardata, I'm going to call, and we'll meet in the middle of the river, and we'll change sides. You come back this that side, and I'll go back your side." Which is what we did. We several times descended to river level to look at barges and things like that, which might have been being used by the Japanese, and might be carrying ammunition or oil drums, or even troops. And we didn't see any signs of movement. As I said, the Japanese were pretty clever. And of course, I was myself at that time completely inexperienced. And he and I didn't see anything. So we changed over and started on the way back. And when we'd been going for about 10 minutes, I hadn't noticed where he was on the other side. Although we were roughly the same altitude, the same distance, same height, same distance apart as we were at the beginning, I didn't see him. When he called up and said, "Gavin, my aircraft's been hit. I've got glycol fumes coming into the cockpit. The engine's overheating. I'm going to have to bail out." And I said, "Where are you, Johnny?" He said, "Well, you're immediately west of you, about 2,000 feet. I picked up some flak when I went down to look at something. Probably those barges that I'd seen where there was no movement. Anyway, I could not see him. I looked everywhere. I looked down, and I went on looking and started doing a circle in that area, looking into the area, expecting to see smoke going up where the plane had finally crashed and all that sort of thing that caught fire. And nothing. It just went out of sight completely. I lost him. And I had to fly back to base. Well, I hadn't been navigating, I'd been following him. And there were many valleys going up off the river in a northerly direction, and I got into the wrong one. And I was flying on about 11,000 feet to be above the peaks of these low Arakan Mountains, very inhospitable, very rocky, lots of trees, nowhere you could bail out, you'd stand, you'd be absolutely on a tree or on a precipice or something. There's no way out. The airplane, of course, was nowhere to land. It would crash and catch fire. And I began to get nervous. I was watching the petrol gauges, and they were getting very low. And I hadn't a clue where I was. And I, time-wise, I should have been just about nearing base, but I wasn't. And also, the mountains on the other side were getting higher, and I found that I was well off course. I kept calling on the radio for a Homer, which you could do. They would then send out wireless signals, pinpoint your aircraft, and then say, you are east of where you should be, or which is west of where you should be, which is what I was. And because of the hills, the signals were interrupted, I couldn't hear. Eventually, I got a very weak signal saying, answering my thing, saying that they were replying. They picked me up, and that I was at a place about 18, 20 miles off course, in nearly up to it. So I altered course almost right angles to head towards it. And at this time, the lights started, the red lights on it for the fuel started blinking, warning me that the tanks were nearly empty. And I could see that with 60 miles or so still to go, that there was no way I'd make it back. I'd have to bail out or crash with the aircraft in this hilly, mountainous country, hilly, a forested country. And I remembered that there was another forward airfield. They were only bulldozed out of the ground by bulldozers, landing place nearby. I headed for that, saw it, and went into land without any signals at all. It was half gliding the way back, losing altitude gradually to save petrol, save. And the lights actually, we landed safely, and as I landed, they went out, and the propeller stopped. There was no petrol and it coasted to a stop. I had to be towed back. They stayed on the end of it. They'd seen what happened. The plane had landed, the propeller stopped, and I was stuck on the airfield at the end of it. Well, I couldn't be left there because other planes would be using it later or earlier. And a big petrol bowser came out. No, it didn't. A tractor. And they pulled me back to where the bowsers were. I had to go on back to Calamio, which was another 18 miles. And they filled me up, and I took off, went back. Very lucky indeed.
What happened to Johnny Johnson?
It's an epic tale. A long story, but I'll try and keep it short. What happened? He the last thing I heard from him is, I'm bailing out now. His plane was on fire. His engine has been, the petrol tank's been hit. And he said, I'm bailing out. I never saw him. And I never heard another word from him. He turned up at the squadron 22 days later. He had walked through the jungle and these mountains, up valleys and that. He was a very experienced Canadian. He had enough Horlicks tablets and things like that to keep himself going. When he walked in, he was a skeleton. But when he landed on the ground, the first thing he did was to hide his parachute. He had seen, as he was coming down, Japanese scurrying across the hills with some Burmese, obviously looking for him. And he then hid up in a bush or bushes until it was nightfall. And they gave up looking for him. Then he had a nightmarish experience. In his long trek back, he moved only at night for safety. His first troubles were thirst and hunger. And he used to have the most awful nightmares where beautiful food was being served to him and he was starving to death in the daytime and having his wonderful meals at night in his sleep. He was squeezing water out of muddy pools and things like that into a cloth and then dripping and putting water tablets into it to dissolve any germs and drink this filthy liquid, colored liquid, but hopefully pure. he had various odd experiences walking around. Once he ran into at night a tribe of baboons. Now, all he had with him was his flashlight. He'd lost his revolver. It had slipped off. It landed, went in the air, and he was descending. And they would follow him along. To them, he was a threat and an alien. And the male baboon was in front and doing this thing. And they had big teeth and big mouths. it's a weapon. They don't eat meat. And all the other monks, there were about 30 or 40 or 50. And for about 3 miles, they followed him through the jungle, threatening him, jumping down in front of him and dancing with rage and all this sort of thing, you know, until he got out of their area and they thought, well, that's goodbye to him. But they were very unfriendly for him. But it was frightening him. And every time one of them came up to him, it looked as though he had a torch. He shined it, eyes up suddenly, and they would scuttle back to the top of the field, and then he'd move on, and then come down again, and it was repeated all through the night. One night, he passed on this jungle trail, a troop of Japanese, about 8 to 10 Japanese, walked, sharing the same path, walked right past him. They were talking, they were tired. He was wearing his khaki overalls, and they thought he was another Jap, probably there. They paid no attention to him. Another time, he had crossed a dried up riverbed called a Chong, and as he got to the other side, he disturbed a small boulder, and immediately a Japanese voice, sentry watching that Chong, called out the equivalent, "Who's there?" You know, and he said nothing, and this Japanese came out, and he saw Johnny. He didn't have his gun in his hand, and Johnny beat a hasty retreat back across the Chong, chased by this chap, and he was well ahead of him, but when he got to the other side, it was about 100 yards, he hid behind a sort of hawthorn bush, which was opaque enough not to be able to see through. It had leaves on it. And the Japanese stopped and thought, now which way has he gone? He was obviously on the other side, debating whether Johnny was there or whether he was somewhere else lying quiet. And suddenly he decided, he rushed around the tree, and he'd found a nice size boulder about that size, he'd hold it in his hand. And as the Japanese came for him, he went for the Japanese, and he banged him with this rock on the side of the head. I don't know whether he killed him or not. He says, I don't know, but he says, I knocked him out completely. And then I had to make my escape, because they looked for him when he wasn't back, and they sent out a search party to find him. And if he wasn't dead, they'd be after him. That was not the last thing. The last thing was, as the march went on, the 18th or 19th day, he was coming to near where the British forces in Burma were facing the retreating Japanese forces. And he went to ground for a couple of days, an old Burmese couple who hid him and fed him, gave him rice and water and things like that. And he thought, hold on, I'll make the noise of guns got closer, I'll make a shot for him. And he got through between the lines in an area where there wasn't any firing. And then he got close to the British lines. Suddenly, an Indian soldier called out, "Who goes there?" And bang, 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 and bullets all around his feet. He said, "You know, I was nearly killed by my own side," reporting back. And he was shouting to them in his best Hindustani, which he didn't know very much of, "I am British," and all this kind of thing. And eventually, this idiot with a gun was told to stop. And one of the NCOs called an officer, there was only out there calling, saying he's British. And he got back safe. The next day, they got him back to us. And the next day, he walked into our squadron, a skeleton. He never flew again. He never fought again. He wasn't allowed to by Air Force regulations. And for medical reasons, he was very nearly mad, very nearly. And he's perfectly well now. We talk to each other on the phone now and again.
He has quite a reputation hasn't he, for World War II pilot?
Yes, he was.
Yes.
He lives in Prince Edward Island, off Newfoundland in Canada, and is married. I met them years later in Palm Beach, down in Florida. They came down to South for a holiday. And as I say, we send each other Christmas cards. We talk on the telephone. And he was surprised, because I was his, coming from Burma, from the Middle East. I was posted to the squadron, but it became his number two. And he always thought that he was the daddy of the regiment, but he was about the oldest of the pilots. And then he would have been about 30, 31. And I was a year older than he was. And he didn't know this until well long. He said, I always thought I was older than you. I said, no. I said, well, I always looked much younger than my age, in any case. But, no, it all ended well. Looking plump and happy.
Yes,
and
yes, that must have been a really epic journey back to,
he,
to base.
His report, his survival report, was very, very interesting. It was submitted to the Army and to the Air Force. And his experiences and the knowledge he brought, all that was recorded. And they gave him a military cross for evading the enemy and bringing back lots of information, which would help future pilots if they ever found themselves in a similar circumstance, not to give up, how to defeat circumstances, and how to make the best of it and get back to being useful, also, or useful pilot again.
And of course, you were going to face this later on, weren't you?
I was.
You were going to face something similar later
on. Oh, yes, yes, I was.
When you crashed.
Yes.
Yes. So the Japanese at this stage were retreating, were they?
They were retreating, yes, they were. And all their fighter aircraft, they only left reconnaissance aircraft behind in Burma, which is why we were never bothered with Japanese fighters, which had been very effective until I arrived. Thank God they went before, just by got there. They were being withdrawn to help the Japanese forces in the Pacific, who were trying to resist the American advance and take over so many Pacific islands, leaving, as I say, no air cover at all, but reconnaissance aircraft to report our army movements to Japanese generals and that, so they helped them in their retreat to keep holding us up.
And here you were in hurricanes, were you?
They were hurricanes.
Hurricanes.
Well, okay. I went back to 28th Squadron. As I mentioned, it was a fighter recce, fighter reconnaissance. But it was not my cup of tea. We carried cameras. We took photographs, as well as being allowed at times to go and do a little bit of armed reconnaissance and let off steam by firing our guns. Our primary job was intelligence, and to take photographs from air, verticals and obliques, to help the army know about where they were going to go and be attacking next. This was, to me, not what I wanted. And I put in for transfer to a fighter bomber squadron. And I was, after I'd been in the 28th Squadron for about 5 weeks, I was transferred to 60 Squadron, which was just my cup of tea, what I wanted. But when I arrived at 60 Squadron, I found a disheveled, disheartened, rather quiet mob of young pilots, much younger than me, who seemed to be kind of lost. They didn't have the organization amongst themselves that 28th Squadron had, which was an all-officer squadron that had been around for a long time. All the good officers that had been in the 60th Squadron had gone. They had all these young chaps. They were slovenly. They were untidy anyway. Not untidy, slovenly. And no, they weren't flying very much. They lacked a leader. They lacked a leader. There was nothing wrong with them. They were lost souls, in a sense. I felt I was much younger than, much older than they were. They were all between 19 and 22 or 23. I was by that time 30. I didn't look any older than the oldest of them, but I had been in a first class squadron long enough, 7 weeks, to realize this squadron was nothing like 28 squadron. And my first thing was to improve the morale of these chaps and get them focused on what they were supposed to do. They lost all sense of focusing why they were there. And I'm not taking any credit for this, it was just circumstances. The first thing I did was I thought they were sloppily turned out, untidy, dirty, and I insisted that they... we had a certain number of servants in a squadron that had been a legacy of the old days of India, when you, in the workshops, you always had the men to empty the oil drums out of engines and aircraft engine changes. It was not considered fit for Saabs to have to do that. So we had these what sort of labourers who would do all the dirty work and that sort of thing. And they became almost pets of the regiment, in a sense, because they were always funny, and they were gypsies, and in a sense. They did a lot of things that made life so much pleasanter, because they did the unpleasant things, tidying up, cleaning up. I gave every four pilots one of these chaps. I said, I took them away off the normal duty, which was sitting on their bottoms most of the day anyway. And I said, you're going to have 1724, and you're going to have clothes washed properly and ironed, which could be done, and you've got to turn out clean and tidy. But I said, this is not the important thing. I'm going to take you up, and you're going to fly in formation with me, and you're going to take my instructions. And you've got to do exactly what I want. I'm your leader, and you don't disobey what I say as your leader, otherwise you may die. And that's all they needed. They became a most enthusiastic bunch. 60 squadron in March flew more operational hours than any other fighter pilot squadron in Burma. We have that record. And it was really from that time that I was earmarked for the DFC, and which I didn't get for a year. But that's when they read my logbook at the end of the war. They said, this chap should have had a DFC. That squadron, its record of successes. I've got copies of telegrams here saying, well done, you've killed so many Japanese, blah, 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 blah. And on the last day of March, I hadn't been in the squadron for more than about 6 weeks. It had come out of the slough. It was suddenly one of the most active squadrons in North Burma. My engine picked up a bullet when we went into Straff, strongly held Japanese positions on the side of Mount Popa. I didn't know I'd been hit, my aircraft been hit in the manifold with the noise of firing your own guns, and that you don't hear slams and bangs that hit your own aircraft usually. And carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide came into the cockpit, and I passed out flying back with the squadron to base. And the first thing I knew was waking up on the ground and thinking, what the hell am I doing here? I knew nothing about it. I'd not seen witnessed the accident myself. I'd been in it. The details of the accident I got from the five pilots who were flying with me in the section when I went back, and then they told me all about what happened, and then they all went back and said I'd been killed. But that's another story.
Oh, I hope you're going to tell me about it.
Well, I will, but it's a rather long story. Okay, well, I'll tell you from my point of view.
Excuse me. This is end of reel 7, Gavin Douglas.